Accession number 11938, Reel 8.
Mr. G. Eyston, Reel 8. From the ridge, Mr. Eyston, could you see any signs of German activity?
Nothing directed at us, directly, but Arras was burning quite well in a number of districts of Arras were burning quite well. So we knew that the Germans couldn't be very far away. But against us, there was nothing.
There was no sign of air activity.
Oh, air activity went on all the time. At this stage, there was air activity, but we weren't being dive bombed or anything like that. The dive bombing came the next day, but there was air activity, great air activity, and no doubt it was more observance than anything else, I think. Although there had been some bombing. There'd been bombing further up the road, again, Le Bassy, I believe. But as far as we were concerned, we weren't attacked in any form. But there was great air activity. There was German air activity, I should emphasise. I didn't see any of ours. There was great German activity. Great German air activity. But very little we didn't see anything of ours at all, I'm afraid, at that stage. But Arras was burning quite well in quite a number of areas, not just one area, but quite a number of areas. Arras was burning.
Was there any German artillery going firing?
We could hear shots, but bad to tell whether it was German or it was our own force that was in Arras at the time, because Arras was quite strongly protected, and that could be one of the reasons why we marched around Arras the following day rather than go on the other side of it. But Arras was well protected. I'm saying well protected. There was very little protection to the extent of stopping a German column that was on the run, on the rampage. We had very little to stop them. The following day, certainly our tanks came into play, but up till then, we'd seen very little in the way of tanks at all. We did see one or two of the French, I think they called them the Chars, one or two heavy French tanks that rumbled along the road very slowly. I believe they're a good tank for the time of the day, but in no comparison to what the Germans were using. And I can't honestly remember what the Germans were using at that stage. Because when we were attacked the following night, it was dark and I couldn't even tell what it was then. So we were not attacked in any form at that particular stage. But we were waiting for our own battalion coming to reinforce us, and then we could stand down. Major Jeffries decided about 8 o'clock in the night that the men could stop digging the trenches, and we used the trenches, what had been First World War trenches, and the wire that was still there from the First World War, which had been preserved as a kind of a monument. I don't know whether it's still there or not, but certainly I believe the monument's still there. And whether the trench is still there that was used in the First World War, but we used that the trenches and the wire. And at this stage, Major Jeffries, realising how much the men had done, I think we're talking about 60 miles that marched in 3 days, he knew that he couldn't get much more from them, quite honestly, and they were stood down in their trenches, which meant that each section would have two pickets on lookout for 2 hours on and two off, while the rest of the section got some sleep. And the same with the carriers. They were out on the right of D Company, covering quite a long stretch of miles. I think D Company was covering something like 1,300 yards, and the carriers were doing possibly the same again to the right of there, and they were in the same position where I think one carrier patrolled and possibly two got the heads down or something to that that effect. I don't quite know how they did it, but certainly they were on patrol and trying to get some sleep as well. Because by this time we knew that something was happening the next day. We didn't know exactly what at that stage, but we had a good idea that something was happening the next day.
Had some kind of information come through which had given you this opinion?
Well, maybe it was the fact that I was with Major Jeffries that I knew that something was brewing for the next day. And I think it was that really decided Major Jeffries that he would stop activities to a certain extent. They're still watchful, but now whether anybody got any sleep or not, I don't know. Because we were waiting for the battalion coming through. In fact, the battalion had waited so long for the transport that they set off to march. And they marched about an hour, I should think, and they'd stopped for a halt. And the brigade said they couldn't go any further until the defences on the canal had been fulfilled by 25 Brigade. And they were held up there till sometime in the morning. But we didn't know this, naturally. I mean, there wasn't the amount of wireless communication that we have today. It was nearly all done by dispatch rider. And looking back on things, it was probably a good thing, because it appears that the Germans were picking any wireless telegraphy up that was going. They must have been very, very smart with it. When you read reports today of what happened at this time, the Germans were picking almost everything up. They knew what was happening. So it was probably just as well that we didn't have a lot of radio contact. And the everything was done by DR. Anyway, the battalion had marched, the remainder of the battalion, apart from D Company, had marched to a place called Ulick, about 4 miles away, and then transport brigade held them up till the Labassi was covered and the canal, and then transport arrived, and the battalion arrived in Thielis Wood about 3:30 in the morning. So we'd been waiting all this time, and about 4:30 in the morning the B echelon and the battalion headquarters moved into the wood at Thielis. And I went back to the cook office to replenish my rations, because we'd been away for the best part of 3 days, really, from having a good meal, apart from the one we'd had in the farmhouse, for 3 days. So I went back and stocked up with rations again as far as we could. So the men finally got settled down, I suppose, somewhere about 5 o'clock in the morning. This is on the 21st.
Did you get an impression of their condition at this time?
Well, they were absolutely flogged. It's almost impossible to say just how far a man can go. It's when you think of 65 miles in 3 days and very little sleep in the meantime. We know they kept down for one night, but how much kip they would get, how much sleep they would get, is bad to say, because the adrenaline's running, and even the bravest man, I don't know whether I said this before or not, but there's two parts of bravery. One is the knowledge of what's happening, and one is an ignorance of what's happening. I think most of us knew that something was wrong. Why were we falling back all this time and falling back and falling back? Most of us knew that things weren't going as they should be. We knew that we weren't going to make too big a stand in Belgium. We couldn't. It was just impossible. Because when you've got an army like the Wehrmacht on the move, it takes a lot of stopping. They weren't too bothered about the number of men they were losing or anything like that. Once they're on the move, they take quite a lot of stopping. So we knew that things weren't going quite right. And when we got to Labassi and then moved off again, we were convinced there was something wrong. So for all we didn't know that by this time they were already on the coast, we thought we were just doing a counterattack. We had wind that we were going to do a counterattack. Let's put it that way. We didn't know we were going to do a counterattack. We had wind we were going to do a counterattack. And even before the battalion arrived, we had some idea of where it was going to be. And talking about the Battle of Arras, I think it's as well that we appreciate what the battalion had been through. From the 10th of May, there had been very little or no sleep for anyone, due to the continuous roar of heavy traffic moving 24 hours a day to fulfil the movement of the BEF and the French troops, stores and guns into Belgium and Holland. I don't know who was responsible for the timetable, but every mile of the road was used for every minute of the day. Our movements came through Brigade MTO, right? Until the night of Wednesday the 15th of May, training and defence digging continued as normal. Thursday the 16th of May, the battalion moved as a motorised unit to Adigem on the River Dond in Belgium, 105 kilometres or 65 miles, and dug defences all night. 4 days later, at 03:30 hours, on Monday the 20th, the battalion was back digging defences on the Labassi Canal, 14 miles behind or south of the defences we had been digging in the winter, except that now our defences were facing the enemy from the south rather than from the north. In 3 days, the battalion had marched 65 miles plus two short motorised journeys, dug four sets of defences, used none of them. After reports at Arras, the HQ of the BEF was being attacked by Germans, D Company and the carriers moved to Thielus on the Vimy Ridge under the command of Major Jeffries, arriving at Thielus about midday. Early in the afternoon of the 20th of May, D Company was extended by the arrival of four Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. The rest of the battalion started to march to Thielus, but was stopped at Hullock because 25 Brigade had not filled the battalion defences on the Labassi Canal. The 4th RNFs started the war as a motorcycle machine gun unit. I don't know how they carried their guns in Arras, but certainly were there with machine guns, and they also, we had attached to us a platoon of recce cars, Daimler four-wheel drive recce cars, with two men in each car, and possibly a Bren. They could have had machine guns in them, I don't know.
Were these cars armoured?
Yes, they were armoured, just room for two men at the front, the engine at the back, and they were four-wheel drive cross-country Daimlers. I don't know when the changeover was, and I still can't remember how the machine guns were transported. After the NFs took over, Major Jeffries went off in one of the carriers to recce the D Company's immediate front. He didn't find any enemy out there, and he came back quite happy. And about 8 o'clock, 8:30, he stood the men down for the night. On Tuesday at 3:30, the battalion arrived at Thielus in RSC transport. At the same time, 03:30 hours, D Company, the carriers, and presumably the four RNFs stood too. Stand two probably relates to the First World War, where if there's going to be an attack, it generally came at dawn or dusk. And to stand to was to stand up on the firing point of the trench. The trench, that in those days, being 8 or 10 feet deep. And they had sandbags to stand on to bring them up to the firing position. So stand to was generally half an hour before dawn or dusk, and stand down was half an hour after dawn or dusk.
What did this mean for you, as you weren't in the First World War trenches?
It meant that we were on lookout, continuous lookout, expecting an enemy attack and prepared for an enemy attack for that
hour.
You
hadn't sent any patrols out or anything of that nature?
The NF sent two scout cars round about, but they're not really effective in dark. A listening post is really much better. But I don't remember any listening posts at this stage. We could have had, but I don't remember any. I think when Major Jeffries did his carrier run, he decided that, well, we were pretty safe for the night. But even so, you still took the precaution of standing tall, because 8 hours, anything can happen. So obviously dawn at that time was about 4 o'clock in the morning. During the stand to, and even before dawn, numerous planes were seen overhead. But by this time, the battalion formed the consensus that if a plane didn't attack us, we didn't attack it, because the trace of bullets in the Bren gun magazines was giving our positions away. So we decided, I don't know whether there's any orders to that effect, but we had decided among ourselves it was better to keep the guns quiet and not be seen, let them find out where we were. If they attacked us, certainly we replied. After stand down, the battalion was allowed to rest until 9:30, and then it was put on half an hour's notice to move. So we can appreciate now the battalion has marched 65 miles, it has dug 4 defences, and it's had a real rough time even before we set off on any attack. Colonel Miller was caught a brigade, and although we were north and east of Arras, the brigade would mount a 2-battalion attack west and south of Arras, then southeast to the first objective, Erin-sur-Cojeul, and then to the second objective on the Sensee River, Crossels. Each battalion to have 1 battalion of tanks, field guns, and anti-tank under command. The start line, the Arras-Doulon road southeast of Arras. About 1100 hours, I took Major Jeffries to the head of the column, D Company, waiting to join the road, the Lens-Arras road, at 11:30. We sat for a short time. He had a look I hadn't seen before. I knew he was tired out, but this was something different, a kind of depression or dejection, both unknown to Major Jeffries. Not wanting to pry or in any way be insubordinate, I finally discovered that the French, who were supposed to come from the south and meet us, were not going to set off. The artillery and the RA anti-tank were unable to join us.
Did he say this? Or
he told me.
While you were sitting there at the head of the column?
Yes, because I could see he wasn't his usual self. And I said I didn't pry, but obviously I did do a little bit. And I think he was glad to talk to somebody about it. Because I believe that he's under instructions not to pass this on. And I think he wanted somebody to know what the situation was before they set off. I don't believe the company commanders have been told. I think this was something between him and Colonel Miller, and probably brigade and wherever the order, well, brigade, because that's where the orders came from. But I think it was a bit of a secret, quite honestly, between him and Colonel Miller. And he obviously wanted to tell somebody. He was so full that he's there to do an attack, and the force that's going to meet us doesn't set off. The artillery that we're going to use to support the attack is not going to join us. And it was a look I hadn't seen him before, because he was I wouldn't say he was a jolly fella. Optimistic. You can't say he was a jolly fellow. He wasn't. He was a serious type of a man. But he was optimistic most of the time. But this was something strange.
What were your feelings, your own personal feelings, when you heard this? Because at this time you would know you were going to a major attack.
Yes. I would say it was a bit of a numbness, quite honestly, because it was our first attack. We had no idea, really, what was going to happen. And this second blow, the artillery not coming and the French not coming, that really was a sickness, or there was a kind of a numbness, I think. But fair play to the Major, and he up and he off. When the time came, it was 11:30, he was out there in the front, and he set off and he took them forward. There was no, it had gone. But I'll always remember this, because it was so unusual for him to feel that way, or to look that way. And I'll always remember this.
Did he march at the head of the column?
He went to the head of the column and left me to find my own way after that. He just went, he said, well, I'm off with the D Company. And he up and off, and I didn't see much of him anymore for that, because later on he grabbed a carrier and he went off in the carrier. So I was left on my own devices.
Whereabouts were you in the
I followed D Company. I followed D Company, and I tried to stay with them because they were the centre. We're going to be the centre of the attack. It was a good place to be. As the advance went on, well, at 12:30, or somewhere around 12:30, we had a 10-minute break, and then shells came over the top. Missed us by about 200 yards, but they fell on Morigel. Now, whether that was bad ranging, and they missed us because they were directly overhead, it could have been bad ranging, or it could have been that the support of the 8th Battalion going through Morigel. No, I don't know. I never did find out. I didn't stop to find out, I'm afraid. Crossing the River Scarpe at Louise, a 20-minute halt was called. That must have been about 1:30, I should think. No, I think we left at 1:35. So, yeah, about 1:20, somewhere about there. They called this 20-minute halt.
Just before you go any further, did you catch the mood of the march? Because you'd marched quite a distance by then, from Tilley right down to Lewes. Did you? I know you're in a wagon on your own, but were you able to catch the mood of the march? Were the men in any low spirits or high spirits? Was there much chatter at all?
I think Major Jeffries, and I think it was Major Rodham, to see them stepping out in front. And when Major Jeffries stepped out, he stepped out. There was no messing about. He was a long, thin bloke, and he could march alongside anybody. And when he stepped out, he stepped out. And I think that gave the men a different heart, gave them a different lift altogether. And for all the shells were going overhead, I think the men were in quite good spirits at this stage. For all they were tired out, maybe that's the idea, is to get them tired out before they go into battle. I don't know. But they were tired, but they were in really good spirits when, at this stage, at the start of the battle. And after crossing the Scarpe at Lewes, they stopped 20 minutes. And then they took the extra armaments and ammunition from the platoon trucks. And the platoon trucks were left behind. So that meant at that stage I was the only soft-skinned and wheeled vehicle in the attack, because they all drew back. But at this stage, again, you've got to consider what happened to the Ren gun men in the sections. And the Ren man in each section, you know, three sections to a platoon, three platoons to a company. And these second man, because then he's lumbered with boxes of 10... magazines for the Bren, when they are heavy. Oh, they are heavy. And the mortar men, the 2-inch mortar men, they load with six shells they had in each hand, and they get heavy. The riflemen, they were given bandoliers. That's like a linen pouch with 10 rounds in each pouch. And I suppose there's maybe 10, 20 of these pouches on each bandolier, and it just slips over your neck, and you can draw these out at the time, because the pouches then were the Bren gun carrier pouches, the Bren gun magazine pouches, the square ones, the little ones with the 5 magazines in, they'd gone, and it was now everybody used Bren gun magazine pouches. So the weight then was terrific for the men to carry. They were, you know, they were sort of bogged down really by a little bit of weight at this stage. But the attack still went on. And approaching Wagon Low, the enemy shelling got heavier, and the battalion got into the artillery formations with B on the right, D Company in the centre, C Company on the left. As I explained earlier about the asphalt roads and the sunken roads, I was more or less compelled to select a road for myself. And I took, rightly or wrongly, I took the asphalt road. I think it was probably right in the sense, but I took the asphalt road. And I could see the attack going on below me. Now the tanks, although I hadn't seen them at this stage, they'd gone before we reached the starting line. We never even saw them. And they'd met some enemy resistance, but they'd done a good job. What the enemy we did meet at this stage, I would say they surrendered rather than were captured. The tanks had gone through them and they were just shattered. I think this was the first time it had ever happened to them. And, well, they just gave up the ghost and they were taken, and I don't think there was any force used at all.
Did you see any at this point yourself?
I didn't, no. Not close to. I saw it happening in the distance, but I didn't see any of them face to face, not at this stage anyway.
How bad was the shelling at this stage?
It wasn't terrifically bad, but it was there, you know. I mean, you knew it was happening, and you can see it going up now and again round about you. And there was a fair amount. Now, through Daneville and going towards Attingcourt, I was Major Jeffries in my sights, and he was generally good to see because he's a tall, thin lot of a fella, and as I've said, he had his own peculiar stride, so he was really pretty good to see, even from a distance. Mind, I had a good idea where he should be. So we just carried on, and the attack was going quite smoothly at this stage. But as we were going a bit further on, I looked across the fields below me, and I saw somebody with his rifle in the air pointing in the direction of the advance. This is an army signal for enemy in the direction of the muzzle. You know, the muzzle of the rifle, if you've got the muzzle there, it's the enemy's in that direction, which was where we more or less expected him. And then if you sort of bend the elbow and lift the rifle up and down, that means many enemy in that direction. Well, this fellow was always sort of dancing. So he looked more like a red Indian doing a war dance than somebody giving the signal. In the end, I thought that he was probably trying to signal me that maybe Major Jeffries had left a message or something, because I was still doing runner, you know, apart from my driving and batman, I was still sort of his runner in a sense. And if he had any messages, it was generally me that took them. In fact, I was quite well known throughout the battalion for all this. And I thought this fellow was trying to signal me that there was a message or something, you see. So as soon as it was possible, I got down off the tarmac road and into the fields. And as I approached this, I saw he was a very jolly corporal from C Company. I'm not sure of his name, but I think it was Big Charlie Brown. I could be wrong, but I'm not sure it was Big Charlie Brown. By this time, there were two or three men trying to hold him down. And all I could hear was, "Let me get at the bastards! Let me get at the bastards!" When he was still throwing his rifle about in the air. And then I shouted, "Well, what's the matter with him?" Well, I realised that he was going berserk. And when he turned towards me, I nearly went berserk. Because instead of the big round face that he had, his cheek was hanging below his chin. And all I could see was the red and white bones of the cheek and the teeth all hanging there. Well, then I knew what the real trouble was. And I got a couple of lads to throw him in the truck and other two that were slightly woody behind him. And whipped them back to advanced headquarters where the MO was.
How far back was this?
That, at that stage, was probably in Daneville. They were creeping forward, but they only moved in bounds, if you know what I mean. They weren't coming steadily forward. They would make a point So Brigade knew how to get to them, and we knew how to get where to go back to them. So I'm nearly certain that at that stage the advance HQ was in Danville, where I could be wrong. Just 40 years ago. When I got back, my thoughts were to get to Major Jeffries as soon as possible to explain why I'd been absent. Now, in Agincourt and Agny, there had been some, I wouldn't say it was resistance, but there'd been some mopping up to do. So the two flanks had got delayed. And I got myself through Agincourt and took the Ashford Road out towards Borains. Now, I could tell that we were going up. I was going up a bank and the road was rising. And I was approaching the skyline. As I sort of got on the skyline, was silhouetted, a grey object about 3 inches wide and 5 inches long skidded along the road in front of me. And I thought, well, that's a shell if anything is, so I put my foot down and away like mad. Just as I did, because one went up just behind me.